Welcome to the Sussex County Council meeting of October 29, 2019. First thing is the approval of the agenda. Mr. Lawson.
Thank you, Mr. President, and good morning, members of council. At this time, I have no recommended changes to today's agenda.
Okay, move to approve the agenda.
Take a motion.
Motion, Mr. Wilson.
Second.
Second, Mr. Burton. Any questions?
I'll sit down. I'm going to make one.
Take the vote, Mr. Hudson.
Yes.
Mr. Riley.
Yes.
Mr. Wilson.
Yes.
Mr. Burton.
Yes.
Aye, we have motion carried. We had copies of minutes of October 22nd. Any questions, corrections, concerns? Hearing none, they'll say and approve. Correspondence, Mr. Moore.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. There are two letters, and the first is from Make-A-Wish Foundation, thanking council for their generous donation, and also from the Rehoboth Beach Little League, and that's all, Mr. President.
Any correspondence from council? Correspondence from council. Public comment, Mr. Guy. Thank you, sir. Paul Rigger.
Good morning. Paul Rigger, 18171 Forest Road, Georgetown. With the nursing home, convalescent home for the age ordinance, when you removed it from special use exceptions and moved it into the other sections of the code, was an excellent move. It belongs there now where it belongs. But still left under the special use exceptions, just one of them is the asphalt batching plants or concrete batching plants, cement mixing plants, as a special use exception. If it's like a land use decision, and if I think it follows the same as the ordinance that you did last year, beginning, it follows the same principle. If it's a land use decision, it should go in front of planning and zoning and then county council. If you have conditional uses for minor things, that should be minimal conditional use or just put into a zone where it belongs. It should not be able for somebody in an AR, GR, or another zone to come in simply in front of the Board of Adjustment to get a special use exception to be permitted to do a concrete mixing plant, an asphalt plant in that district. I still believe that there's not the same classifications for approving it, for denying it, or approving it. I think that through the Board of Adjustment, it's a lot easier process for the requirements versus your requirements. It wasn't hard to write that last ordinance, but it worked. This one is a simple move to remove it from Board of Adjustments under a special use exception and put it in its own place where it belongs for the conditional use to come before planning and zoning and yourself. And if the other ones after that one may want to look again and revisit and have planning and zoning take a look, or actually you all should take a look and decide what the county council should regulate, as far as not regulate but be the one to make the decision whether it belongs there or doesn't belong there. It should not be left up to Board of Adjustments. And if you don't make that decision to go forward with that, it just leaves everything wide open for confrontation, and it doesn't seem to be a fairness for everybody.
Thank you, sir. Dan Kramer.
My name is Dan Kramer. A while back, I told you guys that Purdue is not coming into Delaware, down there to Delmar. Now, I want to know what's going to happen with that $125,000 we gave to Delmar. It ought to be given back. Now, the next question I have, you guys keep approving to go and take Greenwood's sewage, Ridgeville sewage, and haul it to Seaford, and then dump it out there in that river. Question I have, are any one of you willing to drink that water? If you ain't, then you ought not be voting for it, because if it's that bad, Hans ought to be drinking a gallon a day to make the way to prove that it's good and clean, because it ain't clean. If but you want to put it in the river? Then you guys want to claim that, oh, the farmers do all the wackos, want to claim the farmer does the bad stuff, when you guys are approving this bad stuff going into the river. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Lawson, next.
Thank you, Mr. President. A couple presentations this morning to get us started. First is a presentation by the Delaware 4-H Association. We are joined by Caleb Scott, the 4-H program assistant, who is going to tell us about their trip to Montana. I know we have other members of the 4-H group here. We'd like to introduce you guys and come forward. Welcome and thank you very much.
So, hello members of the council. My name is Jenna Anger and I'm a senior at Sussex Central High School.
My name is Kyle Morris. I'm a senior at Sussex Technical High School.
My name is Emma Sporpaglione and I'm a junior at Sussex Academy High School.
So we thank you so much for your generous donation to our Sussex County 4-H exchange trip. In the summer, in July, we were able to attend Stillwater County, Montana, and have an exchange with them so we could see their 4-H programs and the experiences that we can have there. And then previously, the summer before, they came here, so we showed them our great state of Delaware. So we're going to have some pictures and kind of explain our trip for you guys.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay, so this is just our trip on the way there, our first day getting there, our flight to Montana. We had one layover, and then the first day we went and saw a pillar with
Pompey's pillar,
and it has a signature of
Lewis and Clark
on the pillar on limestone.
So it was cool.
So then the next day, we went on a little hiking trip around that river there. And then we also got to explore one of the local mining facilities they have there. One of the exchange person's father actually works at the plant. So it was very interesting. We got to go down into the mines. I believe it is a platinum mine. Mm-hmm. It's a platinum mine. So we got to go down there, explore. They showed us all the different equipment, all the different tunnels and systems. We got to see the vehicle repair bay. We got to see the actual loading station that they have to take the trains up to the surface to process actual platinum. And they also gave us their own essentially keys that they have for safety. So you'll see in that picture at the board right there, they have what's called miner's tags, and essentially once you go down in the mine, you put them on that board right there to the location that you'll be at. If there's ever an emergency or anything like that, then they'll know if you know where you are when you're down there, and you know, make sure that you're all safe and all right if anything does occur.
They did tell us that we were 2,500 feet below ground, and a lot of people, they get down in the shaft and they completely freak out because they've never experienced total darkness before. So that was really cool. And then they also said that there has been more people on the moon than there was down in the mine. So that was pretty cool too.
Did any whitewater rafting while you were there?
Some of them did. I chose not to because it was very, very cold. I did.
you might get wet.
Yeah, so actually that day, instead of going whitewater rafting, we went to the Montana Silversmiths, and we went to the factory and went behind the scenes and got to see how like the belt buckles were made and the different layers, the different people that kind of make all of the silver stuff there. So that was pretty cool. So on July 4th, we had our family day. So we, Kyle and I, stayed with a brother and sister, and we got to actually split up. And I went to Red Lodge. It's kind of one of the bigger towns in Stillwater County, and they had a really cool parade, a lot bigger than like the Laurel 4th of July parade. So they had a bull in the parade, which is really cool. And then that night we went to Laurel, Montana to watch the fireworks. So that was pretty cool. And then
Red Lodge is a cool place.
Mm-hmm. I really liked it. It's a really rustic kind of little town.
Been there numerous times.
Yeah, definitely. And what did you do?
Yeah, so I spent my day out in the wilderness, hiking around the various mountains and lakes and such as that. I believe the trail was, I want to say 4 to 5 miles in total. It goes a lot farther, but we just stopped at that lake there for the day, and we, you know, rested, ate lunch, and all that. It was a really nice walk, as you see, absolutely gorgeous view, and you know, a great time to spend with all the exchange people.
So, my family decided to take me up to the top of the mountain, and so on July 4th, I was playing in snow fields and on glaciers, and so we just four-wheelered up to the top of the mountain. It was like 10 miles up, and like on the switchbacks, the trail was 10 miles away. It was really cool. It was cold. And then it started to snow.
So on July 5th, we went to Beartooth Pass, which is one of the highest points of elevation, and we got to experience snow. And you can see all of us there in the picture. The snow was piled up that high. It was taller than us, so it was crazy. We also went to little cities around there called like the Top of the World, Cook City. Got some souvenirs, some stickers, so it was really cool. We had a snowball fight on the top of the mountain, and you could literally look down, and it just kept going. Like, it was insane. And there was a lot of little creatures up there. I liked the chipmunks a lot, and then there was woodchucks. It was crazy to see what was really on top of the mountain. And they told us that normally there's like 20 feet of snow up there, so the people, they literally can't leave their houses. So.
Wow. They closed that road in the winter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They closed. It's from like Memorial Day to Labor Day is when it's open. And then we started to go to Yellowstone that day too. So it was a lot of traveling, a lot of experience in the wilderness.
So then on July 6th, we spent the entire day traveling around Yellowstone. As you can see, we got to see Old Faithful there, got to see some bison and the various bacterial ponds that they have within the park. And we stayed over by the Grand Hotel that they have there. That's where the some of those bacterial pools are. And as you can see, most of them are starting to go either dormant or dying. As you can see in that smaller picture right there, part of that bacterial pool is actually gray, indicating that it is dying. And I believe they said that was due to some of the tourists and just like an overall climate effect on the park. So that was pretty interesting to see, because I had previously been to Yellowstone 2 years before. So when I got to go back, it did look a little different than I had originally saw it. But it was a good time. We got to experience Old Faithful and just travel around, see all the different animals, you know, bison, the bears, you know, the various variety of wildlife and experiences.
And then Emma, Brittany, and I, there's a picture of us on the, I forget what river it was, but they had black sand, and that was, like, amazing to me. Emma?
All right, so then on July 6th, we were actually in Wyoming at that point, and we went to the Cody Rodeo, and then we went and saw the Buffalo Bill Museum, which is a really big museum on Buffalo Bill and his journey, and then him originally starting the rodeo and being one of the first and most memorable cowboys. And so then we went to the Cody, Wyoming rodeo, which is a little rodeo, and we had a rodeo dinner, but there's not pictures of them on there.
No.
That was cool.
Yeah. I got to ride a bull, which was pretty cool.
Wow.
Yeah, the Buffalo, the Wild Center, it was very cool. It's very incorporating. It had a wide variety of different exhibits. They had natural exhibits, you know, showing the regional, plants and wildlife and things like that. And they had an art exhibit, so it was art from all around that region. They had, obviously, the Buffalo Bill exhibit. And just the various, historical elements of that area. And then that day they're actually unveiling a brand new exhibit. There's their gun exhibit. So they had, guns from all over the world, not just local to the region, but, internationally. They were just unveiling it that day. So that was very, very interesting to get to see that as well.
Yeah, there was like over 7,000 guns in the exhibit. And you got to do like animated simulations. And then also like practice shooting with a handgun with the animations and things, and I did that, and I beat the boys. So that's
what?
Oh.
Yeah, right?
If you pull it long enough, you could have came to Antioquia.
So other Montana fun, up there in the right-hand corner, that was one of the houses. They lived on a sheep ranch. We went there one night for dinner. We had bison, regular burgers. It was really cool, really pretty. They had a huge zip line there, and we got to zip line. I fell off, but it's okay. Then we also got to go to a grizzly and wolf discovery center, and this is like a rehabilitation center for grizzly bears. They have some from Yellowstone, Montana, but then they also have a really huge one from Alaska. Also, we got to learn how to brand one of the exchange students' fathers made branding equipment for us and had the gloves that we had to wear and taught us how to brand, so we got a 4-H brand and we got to bring it back to Delaware. So then we left and it was pretty sad. But we had a lot of fun. I can say that the sights were amazing. Like, I'd never seen something so beautiful. Obviously, I know that we take for granted the beaches that we have here in Delaware, but there's nothing compared to that, the wilderness out there. So that was pretty amazing for me.
Yeah.
So, and we're excited because next June or July, we're going to Texas. And that's it.
What the 4-H stand for, totally stand for? Good luck?
No, so there's the 4-H's, head, heart, hands, and health. So that's kind of what we represent in the background to the organization and kind of how you should live in your daily life to make the best better for other people.
So. Any questions, Council? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Doing all of this, sure.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for sharing your trip with us and visiting with us and explaining where the Councilmatic grant went to. That was very nice. Congratulations. Okay, Mr. President, next we have a presentation from the Delaware Center for Inland Bays. We are joined today by Chris Basin and Dr. Walsh, who are going to make a presentation on the State of the Creek report. Earlier this year, the State of the Creek report for the Herring and Guinea Creek came out in September. I believe Councilman Hudson was at that presentation and encouraged us to have the presentation put on a future agenda so that all of Council could hear the State of the Creek report. So welcome both of you, and would welcome you to come up and make your presentation today. And if Council has any questions, we'll go through the presentation and then by all means ask questions in the end. Dr. Walsh or Chris?
I'm going to guess nothing about bison or buffalo.
I got one of those, yes.
What's that? No bison, buffalo, or bear stories here.
No, no.
Just checking.
Not
just checking.
How about horseshoes?
Thanks. They grow bison in your district, Sam.
Yep. That's your district, really.
Harold Johnson's.
Oh, Harold Johnson does, really.
So my name is Marianne Walsh. I am the Science and Restoration Coordinator for the Delaware Center for the Inland Bays. And I really thank the council for inviting us to give you this presentation this morning. We feel like we brought some good science to understanding what's happening in some of our creeks and the bays. So last month, the center released its third State of the Creek report. It was produced with the help of a number of state, county, and university partners. And in this report, we compile environmental data that we use to assess the health of Herring and Guinea Creeks. And together, those form a major tributary system that flows into Rehoboth Bay. Previously, we had issued reports for Love Creek and for Derrickson Creek. So the State of the Creek reports are part of an initiative at the center called Your Creek, and that initiative introduces residents and visitors to their local creeks and to the work that the Center for the Inland Bays does. We had previously completed two other reports, as I said, for Love Creek and Derrickson Creek. The State of the Creek reports provide communities with valuable science-based information on the health of their local waters. These are the waterways that they live near and use regularly so that they can become informed advocates for the protection of those waterways. The report highlights the values of these creeks. It highlights the potential threats that we see to those values, and it talks about what concerned citizens can do to help. As you may be aware, the Center for the Inland Bays is one of 28 national estuary programs that are responsible for developing and implementing comprehensive conservation management plans for estuaries designated by Congress to be estuaries of national significance, and our inland bays are one of those estuaries. Our mission is to preserve, protect, and restore Delaware's inland bays and their watershed, and we do this through education, through science and research, through restoration projects and public policy. The synthesizing environmental data, like we've done in this report, and interpreting it for the public is a really important part of what our program does. So I circled there the location of Herring and Guinea Creeks. They flow into the western part of Rehoboth Bay. The watershed for the creeks, which is shown here outlined in red, drains nearly 34 square miles of land. A number of smaller streams flow into both of the creeks, including Chapel Branch and Phillips Branch. And Route 24 essentially bisects the watershed, and a dam at Route 24 forms Burton Pond. So this watershed includes areas in Council Districts 3 and 4, so Councilman Hudson and Burton's areas. Both of these creeks in Rehoboth Bay are critical water and recreational resources for residents and visitors and businesses in the area. So I'd like to talk for just a moment about how we assess the health of Herring and Guinea Creeks. In this report, we looked at 8 different environmental indicators, and each of these indicators is a specific watershed condition or water quality characteristic that was chosen because it can be measured consistently over a long period of time to tell us something useful about how the creek and the watershed are changing. In the report, for each of these indicators, we discuss its current status based on the scientific data, and we look for any significant long-term trends in that data. So one of the most obvious and most important changes in this area is land use. That's no surprise. The Herring and Guinea Creek watershed includes some of the most densely populated and rapidly developing areas in the inland bays. And this is important because different types of land use deliver different types and amounts of pollutants to waterways. Farms and forested areas are being replaced by developed land. And in this graph, you can see developed land. The increase in developed land is shown in red, and decreases in agriculture and forest land use is shown in yellow and green. So the farms and forested areas are being replaced by the developed land, which has increased by more than 68% between 1992 and 2012, which was the last year that we had land use data for. Agricultural land has also decreased by almost 20% and is no longer the largest land use in this particular watershed. This trend is continuing, will continue, particularly in the eastern part of the Herring and Guinea Creek watershed. So the plus areas, the proposed project areas, are shown in the 2012 map on the lower left there in red. So some of these developments are already in progress. And much of this development is very close to the water, which is where it has the most potential impact. When we look at the quality of the water in Herring and Guinea Creeks, the report finds that nutrient pollution, which is excessive amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus, is the number one problem facing these two tributaries, as it is for many of the waterways in the inland bays. That pollution comes from a variety of diffuse non-point sources, including wastewater from septic systems and land-applied treated sewage, agricultural runoff, stormwater runoff from development, and waste from farm and domestic animals, as well as from wildlife. Too many nutrients result in algae blooms, murky waters, and extreme fluctuations in dissolved oxygen concentrations that can harm aquatic life, as you can see in the rendering on the left there. In a healthy creek, though, which is what we are working toward, on the right, you can see that nutrient levels, when they're balanced, allow clear water to form, and it allows bay grasses to grow. Oxygen is plentiful for the fish and shellfish, and life in the creek thrives. Herring and Guinea Creek, unfortunately, currently look more like the illustration on the left.
So the goal would be get rid of the farmers?
I beg your pardon?
Your goal would be get rid of the farmers?
Well, the farmers are one source, but the sources of...
They're the ones making all the pollution up there.
Well, not all the pollution comes from the farms. It comes from all different types of land uses.
Homes, more so than farmers.
Well, it's... I can't say how it divides out. Actually, developed land, on average, contributes less nitrogen and phosphorus than farmed land because of the fertilizer application. But if the farmers use appropriate BMPs, then that definitely helps.
So where does the nitrogen come from to start with?
It comes from fertilizers, it comes from sewage, from animal waste, a variety of different sources, from the atmosphere.
So where does it start from? The atmosphere, right? It comes from the air, right?
Some of it comes from the atmosphere, yes.
I believe it does.
Some of it does, but it's a very small portion of the nitrogen phosphorus that enter the inland bays that comes from atmospheric deposition, but it is measurable.
The truth of the matter is the nitrogen I put on farmland comes from the air.
Ultimately, I suppose, some of it does.
That's where it originally comes from.
Yes. Yeah.
So I can't see where nitrogen is all this big harm here.
Well, let me show you some of the scientific data here and why it's causing harm to the waters, regardless of where the ultimate source is.
That's important, I think.
Yeah.
Where it ultimately comes from.
No, I agree. Where it comes from is important because that's how we know how to control what's going into the waterways. If we don't know the sources, then it's difficult to put in practices to control it. So Herring and Guinea Creeks are highly impaired by nutrient pollution, and that includes both nitrogen and phosphorus. This is a graph that shows concentrations over the years of dissolved inorganic nitrogen in the creeks. And the red dotted line at the bottom is the water quality standard that's been chosen by DENREC and by the EPA as the level of nitrogen, dissolved nitrogen, that is allowable to maintain a healthy creek. And we should have concentrations that are below that dotted line, and clearly we don't. In fact, average concentrations of nitrogen measured in both Herring and Guinea Creeks are 10 to 12 times the healthy limit. It's one of the more polluted creek systems in the inland bays.
Can I ask, how do they develop that standard?
It's based on different types of uses that are desired for the creek, so for fisheries, for swimming, and so forth. And there are mathematical models developed that show how the nitrogen phosphorus that enter the waterways are processed and ultimately what the dissolved oxygen levels and so forth will be if that amount of nitrogen and phosphorus enter the waterways. And it's based on how much oxygen and what kinds of water quality conditions are needed by the fish and the wildlife and to maintain swimming standards. So it's ultimately done by mathematical models that are maintained by DENREC. So the phosphorus concentrations also exceed healthy limits. And these are, again, showing the healthy limit in the dotted red line. And clearly, the concentrations that we're measuring, particularly in Guinea Creek, are far above that. And in fact, in Guinea Creek, we seem to see a trend of increase in phosphorus over the years. And that's kind of disappointing given the years of work that we've been doing, that the county's been doing, and others have been doing to remove pollution sources. But there always is a lag time in implementing practices and when you see the results, because a lot of that pollution continues to flow into the creeks from groundwater and so forth. So it can take a number of years to see the impacts. When we see the results of these high concentrations of nitrogen and phosphorus, we see dissolved oxygen fluctuating in the creek waters. So this data is collected by the University of Delaware Citizen Monitoring Program, and it indicates that the dissolved oxygen in these creeks frequently falls to very low concentrations on summer nights and early mornings. And this creates conditions that, of course, can harm fish and shellfish and aquatic life and result in fish and blue crab kills, like the picture that you see on the right there. A minimum of 4 parts per billion of dissolved oxygen is generally considered healthy for most aquatic life, fish and shellfish. And you can see that in more recent years, we're starting to get a number of measurements below that level. So that's creating stressful conditions in Guinea Creek in particular for the fish and the shellfish. Another important finding of the report is that in the tidal portion of Guinea Creek, concentrations of fecal indicator bacteria consistently fail to meet the standards for safe swimming and recreational contact. In fact, in summertime samples, we exceed the standard about 83% of the time currently. And this means that there are significant sources of fecal pollution in that watershed. Denmark recently conducted a study to try to look for sources of those bacteria, and their study is preliminary, but it indicated that a rather large portion of those bacteria are probably coming from wildlife, from geese and foxes and so forth, rather than from human sources. That was a preliminary study. They're continuing to do those studies, so we should have more information. But knowing the sources, again, is important for knowing how we can, in the future, control those bacteria in the waterways. So the water quality in Herring and Guinea Creeks is poor, but it's not all bad news. There's also a very good news story in this report. One of the environmental indicators that we used is the number and density of active septic systems in the watershed. Septic systems deliver a significant amount of nutrients to groundwater, even when they're correctly maintained, and that eventually makes its way over the years into nearby waterways. The Herring and Guinea Creek watershed has both a higher number and a higher density of septic systems than most other watersheds in the inland bays. So that's the red area on the map there and shows very high density. However, the good news is that Sussex County is actively working to provide central sewer service to homes in the area surrounding these two creeks. 2 new districts have recently been created in the watershed, and nearly 100% of the properties along waterways east of Route 24 have been converted or will soon be converted to central sewer. That means a lot of nitrogen that won't be going into the creeks and bays in the future. So kudos to the county for doing this, and kudos also to the county for your work on trying to write improved water quality buffer ordinances. In addition, we applaud the county for funding a number of reforestation projects in the inland bays. One of them was planted this past year in the Herring Creek watershed at an abandoned landfill, and the county is also working to do forest and stream restoration projects around the inland bays wastewater treatment plant, which is in the Guinea Creek watershed. So this provides me with hope that we may see improvements in water quality in these creeks in coming years. So this is just kind of a fun picture of a fish passage project that we've been doing at the Burton Pond Dam. The dam is a barrier to the migration of fish into the freshwater headwater creeks above Burton Pond. And in the past 2 years, we've established an eelway at that dam. And this past year, our monitoring shows that we passed tens of thousands of baby glass eels, which you can see in the sieve here, over that dam using this eelway. So that's great news for the ecology of the streams above the dam. And we're currently working with Preston Shell and with DelDOT to do an additional fish passage project at that site, a fish bypass around the dam when DelDOT replaces the dam in a few years, that will allow other migratory fish like shad and herring to get up into those creeks.
Well, those eels, that's bait, right? Is that food? Does that mean for like a food source for the fish?
Well, yeah, they definitely act as a food source. The mature eels get quite big, and they eat other bait fish and other food. It's also of great commercial value. The Asian markets really love these glass eels, and there is a lot of poaching in the U.S. It's a huge problem of these baby eels. It's interesting. They can be worth quite a lot of money. So that's the current state of herring in Guinea Creeks that we wanted to present to you. Despite definite progress in reducing the inputs of nutrient pollution, we know that there's still a lot of work that that needs to be done to address water quality issues in the tributaries. And in addition to the environmental data, the report also contains specific recommendations for some actions to be taken to improve the health of these two creeks. We've been working with the Clean Water Campaign, other partners, to secure additional funding for work like the county's doing to provide better treatment of our wastewater and our stormwater runoff. So these are some of the recommendations that can be found in the report.
You're talking about Central Sewer up there? You said
yep.
we're going to change over to Central Sewer.
Right, Central Sewer is definitely better for the quality of the water. Is that you get much higher levels of treatment through Central Sewer than you do through septic systems.
They didn't really say that up there. I thought that's what it was. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear. So I'm very happy to take questions. I know that Chris can assist me in answering some questions.
Thank you, Dr. Walsh.
I have a question.
Mr. Riley.
I didn't hear anything mentioned about dredging, and I'm curious if you have any opinion on the impact that adequate dredging program would have on the water quality of the bays.
I can handle that one. Dredging and maintaining our waterways is very important for our economy. I think dredging done right can have some beneficial environmental impacts. One of those is the utilization of the spoils that you get from dredging. You can put them into wetlands to restore wetlands and shore up wetlands from erosion and loss to sea level rise. I think the science shows that in terms of a direct water quality impact, dredging probably doesn't do too much for water quality. It can increase some flushing in some areas so that you could have some localized improvements, but it's sort of like a double-edged sword in that way. You can actually increase flooding because you're allowing more water to come up a more well-defined channel. So that's why when we talk about water quality, we're talking about controlling the sources of pollution from the land itself primarily.
And I think you said in your presentation at the dinner that 25 years ago, there were, I think, 12 different single point source sources of pollution, and that today there's none, there's zero.
So there were 12 major original pipes discharging wastewater, and they have all been removed. There still does exist one more pipe into the inland bays, and that's from the Allen Harim facility on Wharton's Creek, which flows into Indian River Bay. And the last time we checked, it was a fairly minor discharge. And I believe the county has given the go-ahead to that facility for their plans to convert that direct discharge to a land-based discharge. I haven't gotten an update on where that stands, but I don't see any reason why that would not occur.
I think it came through planning and zoning. It hasn't made it to us yet.
Okay.
Anything else?
I'm done.
Mr. Lawson.
Appreciate it, Mr. President. Thank you. Thanks for being here today. Very informative. I have a question and a comment. Question is related to land use data you're using in the report. It references 2012. And I guess that segues into my question about future studies related to these two creeks. The county's doing significant septic work right now. Septic conversion work is referenced in the report. And you may have heard Mr. Medlar's counsel state that one of our districts is the equivalent of removing the Rehoboth outfall within the Rehoboth-Lewis Canal. Is there any indicators that you're going to come back and report to us the condition of the creeks in the future years, and perhaps even using different land use data and then seeing what our efforts there for septic conversion has done in these creeks?
Yeah, every 5 years, the center issues a state of the bays report that gives nearly 40 different environmental indicators for the entire inland bays and their watershed. And septic conversion is one of those indicators. We will be issuing the next state of the bays report in 2021. We're already beginning work on it. And we've recently checked into the most recent available land use layers. DLDOT is currently working on doing the 2017 layer. It's not yet available, but it should be available when we work on the State of the Inland Bays report. It would be very easy for us to update the indicators in these creek reports at that time, too. We continue to get new data every year from DENREC and from the University of Delaware for water quality, so we can always keep those indicators updated.
Thank you. Council. Thank you very much.
I got a question.
Mr. Wilson.
How many full-time employees do we have on this watershed?
In the water? You mean for the Center for the Inland Bays?
Yes. How many full-time employees do we have?
We have 10 full-time employees.
Mm-hmm. And what would be your highest paid employee?
You're looking at him. It probably should be Marianne, but you know how it works.
$100,000.
I'm sorry?
Are you near $100,000?
How about you, Sam? Where are you at?
I don't think that's anything to do with what we're talking about here, Sam. No, come on now. Really, it does not.
Are we not giving them so much money? Is this not taxpayers' money we're giving here?
Sure it is. It's not all taxpayers' money.
Well, how come taxpayer can't ask this question then?
Well, you already did.
I did. How much money are we paying you?
How much money are you paying?
We're not paying him anything.
Well, how much? Then we're getting money to Inland Center Bays, right?
I have one quick one,
Mr. Riley.
I just wanted to know if you have any update on the study on the economic impact of the Inland Bays.
We do. Yeah, thank you for asking. So we've started work with the University of Delaware Institute of Public Administration. They're going to be our prime contractor on that, and they're working with the University of Delaware Business School to help out on the analysis. So work has started, and we've got our first check-in meeting in November. I think Todd will be there for that, and so we're going to have input on their draft work. But we're hoping to have that completed by summer of next year. So it'll be a comprehensive study, and very much looking forward to the results, which I think are going to be a really important addition to understanding and protecting the bays. It's their economic value.
Thank you. I should ask Mr. Hans, where's the water going? The sewer, where's the sewer going? Do you have a sewer plant there on this inland bays here?
Are you talking about in the Herring and Guinea Creek watershed?
Yes, I'm talking about she says change over to Central Sewer, right?
Yeah, I think
so. Where's water going?
That's a great question.
Those districts are connected to the county's Inland Bays sewer plant, which is a land base spray operation.
So we're going to take the solid and put it back on the farmland, right? So it run back to the bays.
After the biosolids are treated, yes, they are land applied or taken to the landfill, but primarily land applied.
So it's all recycled, isn't it? It's all made with life spike recycled. So solids goes back on the farmland, then runs back into the creek again.
Mr. Burton?
All right. You said the study would be completed by the end of this coming summer or the next summer?
Next summer, yeah.
So two summers.
Well, I'm sorry. Summer of 2020, if you can believe that.
Okay. I get confused with the word next.
Thank you very much. Thank you both very much.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
Burton.
Yes. We got county.
Try not to hold on, man.